This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Students and teachers headed back to school this week will be asking friends, did you do anything interesting this summer? Anyone who asked Bryce Carlson, a science teacher at Seven Hills School, will learn he had a story no one can match. On June the 27th, Bryce pushed off from Newfoundland in a one-person rowboat. 38 days, 6 hours, and 49 minutes later, he pulled into a harbor in the Isle of Scilly, off Cornwall, becoming the first American to row solo, unassisted, across the Atlantic. We had an opportunity to talk to Bryce last week. Here's the interview. Bryce Carlson, welcome to Cincinnati Edition. Glad you're here today, and welcome back.
Thanks
so
much.
Your trip. Now, you just had this leisurely summer vacation to England.
Now
you're ready to go back to school,
right? Yeah, lots of sun, lots of water. You know, everybody's ideal dream summer vacation.
Very little beach.
So, yeah. And actually, truth be told, there wasn't a lot of sun. There was a lot of cloud and a lot of fog.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, the first question I have in my mind is pretty simple. Why?
You know, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? And it's the hardest one for me to answer. I came across this quote recently that I love and I think is apt here, and that is, the person you spend the most time with in your life is yourself, so you better make yourself as interesting as possible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I love learning new things. I love taking on experiences that force me to grow, learn more about my world, learn more about myself. And this was kind of the latest in that line of adventures.
So my understanding is you are a rower.
Yeah, well, I rowed in college for 4 years, and then I've been involved with the sport for the last 10 or 15 in coaching.
Okay. When did the concept, the idea of rowing across the Atlantic sort of become a serious idea for you?
About 3 years ago, the idea first blossomed then, and there was about a one-year period where the blossoming was happening, right? It became just an idea to something that I was starting to get a little more excited about and started to accumulate resources, reading books, reading magazine articles, reading everything I could about the experience of being on the open ocean, be it sailing, be it rowing, reading all the books that had been published about ocean rowing. And about 2 years ago, that the idea became a committed reality.
So the boat that you rowed, the Lucille, is that something you designed, or is that something that this is a recognized type of boat for open water rowing?
Yes, the latter. In my research, in the preparation phase, I learned there were maybe two major manufacturers of ocean rowing boat, and one was starting to clearly stand out from the crowd as being the fastest, safest, most comfortable boat being built. And that the company that was manufacturing the boat was in Burnham-on-Crouch in England, a company called Rannoch Adventures. And they were building, a state-of-the-art ocean rowing boat made from carbon fiber, had all the electronics and safety gear that a modern yacht would have. I mean, it became the clear favorite. And so I phoned them up and told them what I wanted to do, and we set to work putting together a boat just for me.
So do they sort of custom build these boats?
They have a mold. They have a design, a kind of a standard design for the boat, for a one-person ocean rowing boat. Okay. So that doesn't really change. But you can customize what electronics you want on board. You can customize a few other things. You can tweak and modify the design a little bit. But the general shape and outline of the boat, that's set.
Okay. And how do you prepare physically for this? I mean, we're not, there's the Ohio River down there, but we don't have any oceans close by.
Yeah. I suppose I can answer that in a couple different ways. I brought a lifetime of athletic experience to this adventure. So to say, how do you train for something like this? Well, it started, when I was a kid, running down the road to play with my neighbors, and then in middle school, taking on a paper route and running the paper route because I wanted to hurry up, get it done, and go play with friends, to high school track, to collegiate rowing, to 10 years of ultramarathon running after that. I mean, I've learned a lot of lessons along the way that were critical for getting through this adventure. But the specific training for the row began about 2 years ago. It included accumulating a lot of time on a rowing machine. I felt I was maybe a little underpowered for the project, so I spent some time in the weight room trying to build up a little more muscle mass. Those two were probably the biggest parts of the training. You know, some muscular endurance training in the weight room, some aerobic training on the rowing machine.
How about psychologically? How did you prepare?
Yeah, and that I didn't explicitly prepare for over the last 2 years. So for that, I leaned more on past experiences with ultramarathon racing and a lot of the same strategies for how one gets through a 24-hour race or a 36-hour race were at play here. You know, in 2015, I joined 11 other runners in a race across the U.S., and that was a 3,100-mile race. And there I learned a lot of, again, the psychological kind of coping strategies or mechanisms on how to maximize your effort on any given day, but still be able to get up and do the same the next day, right? So I want to try to get as many miles in today as I can or complete the miles in as fast a time as I can, but I have to be able to get up and do the same the next day. So I learned a lot in that experience as well.
I know this is a completely ridiculous comparison. My wife and I did, as 2,000 people did, Paddle Fest on the Ohio River. We do it every year. And, you know, you paddle 9 miles and you're paddling with the current, okay? And there is a little
bit of
current.
That's the way to do it.
And, you know, but one of the things you learn is you can have a little burst of energy somewhere along the line, but it's not going to change the long-range outcome of how long it's going to take you to get to your goal. You know, it is endurance even for a short period of time. And the idea of the endurance across the ocean, I mean, where there the goal isn't in sight and there's really not many markers along the way.
Mm-hmm.
That's a completely different thing.
Right. But it is very similar. I do think the analogy is a decent one. You know, someone who's engaging in an activity like that at Paddle Fest, you know, if they have a lot of experience and they're in a canoe or a kayak and they've been out on a number of weekends and completed 8 and 10 and maybe 20-mile paddles, they probably have a decent sense of their body and what they're capable of, what kind of effort they're capable of sustaining for the amount of time it will take to get down the river. And so, you know, there may be moments where a short burst, I don't know if it's a – I'm actually not that familiar, unfortunately, with Paddle Fest. But if they're trying to race someone else,
yeah,
you know, maybe a short burst is valuable in that moment is part of a strategy to get up in front of someone and make a statement or whatever. But then they know they can't sustain that. So then they – once they get in a position, they dial back.
What kind of plan did you have as you left Newfoundland? And you left on June the 27th. What did your plan look like about how you were going to do this?
It was a very loose plan. You know, I knew I was going to experience a lot that I couldn't anticipate, or I didn't know how my body would respond. So I knew any specific plan I might put in place for a day's work would likely be tweaked, would likely be changed, perhaps significantly, over the course of the trip. So I had a relatively loose plan. I knew in terms of structuring the day, it would probably be more efficient to work for 12 hours and then rest for 12 hours.
Mm.
Some rowers, ocean rowers, choose a like 2 hours on, 2 hours off schedule. And that may work for a two-person team or a four-person team where you're mixing up the effort. And so you always have someone propelling the boat in the direction you want it to be going. For a solo rower, I didn't think that would be a wise plan at all, because I think in 2 hours of rest, it's never sufficient to really fall into a deeper sleep and truly recover from the effort. So I scheduled 12 hours of rowing. But embedded in that 12 hours, you know, I broke that into chunks, both mentally and very explicitly logistically. So every 30 minutes, I would take a drink of water. Every hour, I would take in some food or calories. Midway through the day, I would pause for lunch, which meant boiling up some water and then rehydrating one of my dehydrated meals. And because my main desalinator on the boat broke on day one.
On day one.
On day one. My backup desalinator was a manual pump. So every day at lunch after I ate, I would spend 1 to 2 hours manually cranking this pump.
Did you consider, since it was day one that it broke, going back, getting that fixed, and starting over?
For a hot second, and then decided not to. Partly because I had spent the previous week, my departure from St. John's was delayed because the water maker I had, the original water maker I had on the boat, the primary water maker, was not working in harbor. So we spent a week disassembling, reassembling, on the phone with the manufacturer, troubleshooting. And after several days of this, we were no closer to getting the water maker to work. So I bought a new one and had it overnighted from British Columbia out to Newfoundland. We installed that, got it working. It was working perfectly fine in harbor. And then 24 hours later, it stopped working mysteriously.
Okay.
So after all that back and forth, I was done.
You were
with
done.
with this manufacturer, with this
model.
Were you
pretty confident that doing it by hand was going to hold up?
I knew the backup would work. I knew the backup desalinator worked. And it was a simpler model. So in my mind, I thought, well, it's a very simple model. There's only a couple ways in which I think this can break and go wrong. But it was a worry, like, across the whole trip.
That if you've got to have water.
Yeah. So there were a couple really weak parts on the water maker. And I handled those weak parts every day as though they were sacred items. I mean, because if this breaks, I didn't have a backup for those little parts.
Was there a contingency plan for how to pick you up, how to rescue you if that or and we'll talk about weather here coming up, but other things happen. Were there contingency plans?
Yes. There were several ways in which I could call for help if I needed it.
Okay.
I had two separate emergency beacons. Their sole purpose is I push a button and it sends a distress call via satellite to U.S. Coast Guard or Canadian Coast Guard or British Coast Guard. That gets then relayed out to any ships that may be traveling in my area.
And you would see ships?
No. Oh. On a couple occasions, I did see ships. Ships passed close enough that I could see them on my navigation screen and I could see them visually. But the closest any ship ever came was about 4.5 miles.
Oh. They're not seeing
away
you
from
you're small.
Well, they may. I mean, I had a device on my boat that would, one, amplify if they had a radar. If they had a radar on their ship, I had a radar enhancer on mine, so they would see me on the radar. I also had a device that used the VHF antenna to broadcast all the information about my boat, the name of the boat, where I was going, where I was coming from, how fast I was moving, what course I was on. Unfortunately, that piece of equipment broke maybe a third of the way mm-hmm. into the trip. So the ships that were passing me, they wouldn't have seen that information, but they should have seen me on the radar.
So we were joking right at the beginning. What was the weather like? And I know that's, you know, this whole row took 38 days for all practical purposes.
Yeah.
I guess 39 days. So 38 days, 6 hours and 48 minutes. But who's counting except you? And but what was the weather like?
In terms of waves, so how calm or rough the seas were, anywhere from 1 foot waves to 16 foot waves. In terms of temperature, when I started.
When you say 16 foot waves,
yeah.
Because there's a storm going on, or are there 16 foot waves out there, but no.
Well, there's a storm somewhere.
There's a storm somewhere.
Right? I mean, you don't get 16 foot waves without in the absence of wind, right? So wind was pushing those waves up consistently enough over a long enough stretch of water to have built up waves of that size. And so usually if I was sitting in waves of that size, if I was sitting, floating, bobbing in waves of that size, getting thrown around in waves of that size, generally it meant I had pretty strong winds with me as well. You know, waves that size, probably 30 to 40 mile an hour winds.
Are you going with or against the trade winds?
With the prevailing winds.
With the
prevailing. But on any given day, you know, I'll have some angle. You know, mm-hmm. the winds will be coming at some angle to the prevailing west to east direction. very few days were the winds coming opposite the prevailing direction. So for the most part, the winds were coming somewhere out of the west-ish and pushing me east-ish.
Okay. So you say you rode 12 hours and then you rested 12 hours. Mm-hmm. Okay, you're out in the middle of the ocean. How do you know what's going to happen to you while you're resting, right? While you're sleeping?
Yeah.
What happens to
you
the
don't.
Boat?
I will say I had really good weather forecasting. So I had there's a group called WRI that were putting together customized weather forecasts for me and sending me those forecasts every 3 days in good weather or every day in rough weather.
Wow.
So I had a really good idea what was coming, kind of hour by hour or every few hours what was coming. And so when I went to sleep at night, I may have a good idea winds are not going to change over the next 8 hours. I can predict, you know, what the boat's going to do, and I can fix the rudder at whatever angle to the wind to keep me moving in the right direction. Now,
so you weren't necessarily going to be blown completely off course.
Right. I mean, that said, the forecasts weren't always perfect. And very often the winds would change in the middle of the night. And those two things combined with some aches and pains in my shoulders throughout the trip and the fairly narrow space I had to sleep in the cabin, it wasn't a very comfortable sleeping experience. So I very often would wake up every 1 to 2 hours throughout the night. There were very few nights I slept all the way through. Mm-hmm. So I'd wake up every 1 or 2 hours and then check my navigation screen to see, all right, how's my drift? Am I going at least relatively in the direction I want to be going? Have the winds changed? Have the currents changed? And then I could adjust the rudder if necessary.
Okay. How many times did you capsize?
I did stop counting, but I think probably a dozen around there.
And what's capsizing mean in this situation?
Yeah. So capsizing means the boat goes upside down, you know, where I am rolled onto the ceiling of the boat.
If you're in the
inside the cabin, yes. Thankfully, each time I was inside the cabin.
You weren't out rowing when
it
happened.
Right.
Okay.
You know, each time the boat was capsized or rolled, you know, it was generally in heavy seas, heavy enough that they were in unrowable conditions. So there was only one, maybe 2 days I can think of that I was out trying to row in really high seas. So thankfully, each of these capsizes occurred while I was inside the cabin, so I was very, very safe. Now, that said, if a capsize would have occurred, if the boat would have been rolled while I was outside, I would have been okay in that I was always attached to the boat. So even on calm—
By a line.
Yes. Even on calm days, I had a harness around my waist. I wore a harness around my waist and was tethered to a line on the boat. So even if I was thrown off the boat, I would never be separated from the boat, which was really important because there were a number of days where the winds were pushing my boat at a speed that was probably at the limits of how fast I could swim.
So catching up.
So yeah, theoretically, I could have been thrown from the boat and unable to swim to catch up with the boat.
So, okay, you're inside the cabin, you're capsized. Then what has to happen? What do you have to do in that situation?
Stay calm. The boat was built to right itself.
Oh, okay.
So when the boat goes upside down, it's only upside down for a very short period of time. Because the boat is designed so that there's a lot of weight in the bottom of the boat and a lot of buoyancy in the top of the boat. So when it goes upside down, it's very unstable in that position and so very quickly rolls back to its preferred orientation.
What did you take with you? Did you take any books? Did you take tapes? Did you take tapes? Ain't how old I am.
Yeah.
But what did you
I brought one physical book. And that was a field guide to North Atlantic wildlife. So as I saw seabirds and saw marine mammals and fish, I would have some resource to learn a little bit more about them and to understand what I was.
What sort of variety did you see and how often would you actually see?
A lot of seabirds. And I saw seabirds every day.
Even out in the middle?
Even out in the middle, all the way across, there were seabirds every day that I was – at some level interacting with. You know, some birds were very curious and inquisitive and would come right up and kind of chirp and check me out. And others, I don't want to say oblivious. I don't know what their mind state was, but you know, they had a mission of their own and seemed to care less that I was there. Yeah, mm-hmm. But probably a dozen different species of birds, maybe.
What about sea animals? Sea animals, fish.
Yeah, very whales. Few fish. Very few fish. The only fish I saw were the three or four that jumped into my boat. Over
literally.
Yeah. Well, it's unclear to me whether they jumped in or whether a wave kind of thrust them up in the middle of the night. But there were a few mornings I woke up to find some very small fish, maybe 10 inches long, yeah. Very slender, in the boat.
So you, was there any provision? I mean, could you have run a line out and tried to get some fresh food to eat in effect?
Theoretically, yes. I don't know that it would have been very successful, for one. You know, again, I didn't see any big fish yeah. along the way. Now, that doesn't mean they weren't down there. But also, I wouldn't have felt very comfortable doing that. I mean, I have such awe and reverence for the natural world, especially in that environment. I've been in love with the aquatic environment, the marine environment, the oceanic environment since I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And so I think, I don't know, I was more out there to enjoy and be a part of that environment, and the idea of taking from it, I wasn't very comfortable with that idea.
So what, you mentioned this before, briefly, what food did you have?
I had a lot of dehydrated meals, dehydrated rations. So these are meals that were prepared, edible food prepared in a kitchen. And then all the water is removed. So mm-hmm. So all you have to do is add boiling water to effectively heat it up and rehydrate it. I also took a lot of like energy bars, like Clif bars, and there are a variety of brands now. Mm-hmm. And I had several tubs of like powder, sports drink, sports mix powder. About halfway through, however, I had to stop drinking the sports drink because it was contributing to some health problems I've had in the past in other races where you get this exercise-induced gastroesophageal reflux disease.
Oh, okay.
So, I hadn't really considered this ahead of time, but many of the foods I brought with me were fairly acidic foods. And so about halfway through, the more of the foods I consumed and the harder I worked, those two things combined would give me this acid reflux and then some bloating and really uncomfortable.
So a couple questions here at the end. How do you think this experience is going to affect you as a teacher?
That's a great question. You know, I think it will affect me in a lot of subtle and unconscious ways that I can't anticipate now, and I probably couldn't articulate later down the road. I think this is one of the first times in my life I've taken on an activity, an adventure, a challenge, where there is no course laid out in front of me. This isn't something anyone has done before. And so I had to figure out, you know, the nature of the challenge that I was going to experience and put together my own plan, right? And try to learn some lessons from related efforts and areas that other people have gone through. And I think that's what all us teachers hope our students will eventually do for themselves, right? Plot their own course in life, not follow someone else's path, but choose their own, define their own. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, maybe that's perhaps the most profound and explicit way in which my experience will end up in the classroom.
Did you take a diary?
Yes, and didn't really use it.
Okay.
I had hoped I would spend more time recording my thoughts and thinking more philosophically. What does it all mean along the way? And I think the cold, hard realities of the experience were I was just too tired. At the end of each day, I'm trying to, again, I'm maximizing my effort to get as many miles as I can on any given day. And then in order to do the same the next day, I have to maximize sleep. And so I didn't take that much time along the way to reflect.
Is there another adventure like this in your future?
There will be other adventures for sure. What those look like at this point, I couldn't say.
Well, Bryce Carlson, welcome back. Congratulations. Thanks for being here today. Wonderful conversation. And good luck this school year at Seven Hills with the students. I'm sure that you will, in fact, find ways that you can draw on this experience and for their good.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.